What is holy longing? How can we meet our shadow in a spiritual path? And what does shadow work involve? This is the Laboratory of Mind, podcast studying that which is closest to us. Welcome to the Laboratory of the Mind podcast. Today I will have a conversation with Connie Zweig, who is a retired psychotherapist and an author of several bestseller books. Her books touch topics such as shadow work and spirituality. Her latest book is called Meeting the Shadow on the Spiritual Path. Welcome, Connie.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's great to have you here. Could we start by a little introduction? Especially, I'm interested in what has led you to this approach of integrating both meditation, spirituality, and Jungian shadow work. What has led you to these topics in your life?
Okay. Well, thank you. First, the title of the book is Meeting the Shadow on the Spiritual Path that we're going to discuss today. And I'm sorry it's not in Finnish. I hope at some point we can sell the translation to you. So I began meditation at 19. I was very young. I was a student at Berkeley in the late 60s, and I got very involved in transcendental meditation, became a teacher. And then after a few years, I began to notice that the organization, which had been quite open, was becoming more controlling, more hierarchical. And the teacher, who said he was celibate, was rumored to be having sex with women. So I began to become disillusioned. When I spoke up, people didn't want to hear about it. New practices cost more and more money. And because I wasn't trained in psychology yet, I didn't really understand what was happening. But eventually I left. So in 1979, I left the TM movement, and I had a career in journalism and then in book publishing. And during that time, I went into Jungian analysis and began to explore my own shadow, that is my own unconscious process in my dreams and in relationships and in relation to my spiritual life. What I discovered was that when we are young and we begin to practice meditation or contemplation or prayer, we join a spiritual or religious community, we tend to be naive and have this kind of picture in our heads that everything will just be light as long as we meditate enough, as long as we do the practices right, everything will be okay. And there's a denial of the shadow, there's a denial of the dark side of human nature that's kind of built into organized religion as well as alternative spirituality. And so I became more and more interested in that and came out with a book called Meeting the Shadow, which is a collection of experts writing on the topic. And then I went back to graduate school, got my doctorate in Jungian psychology, and wrote a book called Romancing the Shadow, which is about primarily about relationships and how we meet these disowned, unacceptable parts of ourselves in relationships. Like if you have the same repeating fight with your partner, or if you are always attributing something to friends. At first you love them and then you don't like them. You have conflict and then you leave them. whatever the patterns are, the shadow is involved, and it remains unconscious until we learn how to bring it out into the light of awareness and work with it. So later, when I was in my 60s, I began to look for material to read for myself about the issues of aging and retirement and the unconscious. What are the beliefs and feelings and images that are in the shadow about growing older? I couldn't find anything. I couldn't find a single book about that. And so I said to my husband one day, oh my God, I have to write another book. And so I wrote The Inner Work of Age, Shifting from Role to Soul, about the shadows or inner obstacles to our aging consciously and aging spiritually, being able to use the circumstances of our aging as spiritual practice. And so that book has done extremely well. People are drawn to the term shifting from role to soul, which I borrowed from the teacher Ram Dass. And, you know, my sort of framework is that the purpose of aging is to, and the new longevity, which is such an opportunity, is to shift our identity from what we do, our roles, to who we really are. And whether we call that spirit or God or Buddha nature or emptiness or Christ nature or the transcendent, whatever we call it, our task is to begin to shift from what we do to who we are. And that book did so well that the publisher said to me, why don't we go back to this early book that you did on shadow and spirituality and bring out a redesigned, rewritten, revised edition of that? So Meeting the Shadow on the Spiritual Path uses all that we learned from the Me Too movement and all that I've learned in my last few decades to really look at how we meet the shadow in our spiritual lives, with our teachers, with our groups and communities, both in ourselves and in other people. And I think that's what you wanted to talk about today.
Yeah. Yes, this is very important and also interesting topic. When I was reading your book, I noticed that there were many themes that I have also been learning about and touching in my own history in meditative groups and meditative practice. I liked very much this approach that you were talking about, this holy longing, because this touched something in me that I really liked, because I felt like this is something that I have been feeling and, exploring and reflecting during many years. But this phrase, holy longing, kind of nails it very well. So could you tell a little bit about this holy longing? What is it then?
That's what happened to me when I found that term. It's the name of a poem by Goethe. And so I borrow that from him, with all due respect. And that name also really resonated with me when I found it many, many years ago, to describe this restless yearning in us for something more. Some people say it's a yearning for God, for the transcendent. Whatever our lineages, whatever our denomination and our language, it's a call, it's a yearning, it's a longing for something beyond ego. And for many people, even, you know, the poets call it the soul's search for the beloved. So it's as if there is a part of us that intuits that there's something more. Today we call it non-duality and awakening. Mm. But it's that part of us that knows that there's more consciousness, that there's more evolution, and that wants that, desires it, and yearns for it. And if we can learn how to allow our holy longing to guide us, It can bring us to teachers and to transcendent experiences. And that's why, that's how this book is different from books about cults, which don't understand that and are very kind of black and white thinking, you know. These teachers are all bad, they're all cult leaders, and the point is to get you out and back into conventional society. And that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is there's a valid part of us that is leading us there, that is leading us to spiritual experience. But if we land with a teacher who has authoritarian tendencies, who is narcissistic, who has his or her own unhealed wounds, then our longing can go awry. And it can lead us to stay in an abusive setting or an abusive relationship because we're longing for that person instead of the soul longing for the beloved, which is not a person, right? If it lands on a human being who has a shadow, then we can really get into trouble and experience trauma, religious trauma, spiritual abuse, and disillusionment.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really important thing because I think in my experience also when I kind of first became disillusioned with some tradition that I was part of, I felt this tendency to this black and white thinking that, well, okay, all spirituality is something that I should avoid and all the groups and all spiritual authorities. You know, I read Krishnamurti's books and tried to find way there. But somehow I also had this feeling of this longing for something. And within a few years, I found some other ways to kind of approach it and spiritual teachings and these kind of things. But I think that in many cases, it is very hard to find way back to this longing. And but there can be something very important in that longing that you should not kind of dismiss and try to avoid, but find some ways to go towards it in more kind of a constructive and more healthy environments. So,
yes.
Yeah.
So you're really articulating why I wrote this book, because there's no guidance for people who become so disillusioned. And, you know, so I wanted to apply shadow work to spirituality so that people could begin to work through their spiritual wounds and loss of faith and trauma. And so the second half of the book is about that. You know, I think that Krishnamurti, I was with him several times in California. I think he really misled people because he was born into this highly evolved state and told people they didn't need a method or a teacher. And so many people then stopped seeking because of that. And my sense is that that is not the case for the majority of seekers. Majority of seekers need to find a practice with or without a teacher in order to cultivate deeper, wider awareness and expand consciousness. And so, and, you know, we're talking about the risks of that. If we're not aware of our own shadow material, so for example, unmet childhood needs, let's say the need for an ideal parent. And so we unconsciously project that onto a charismatic teacher. We attribute to the teacher whatever we didn't get from our parents. You know, he's unconditionally approving and loving or compassionate or all-knowing. And whatever we attribute to that arises out of our own childhood needs for an ideal parent. But that teacher is human. And so if he loses his temper or he criticizes and shames someone, or he begins to get greedy for money, then what happens? That projection pops, and it's extremely painful and disillusioning to recognize the human fallibility of that person whom we needed to be so perfect, right? And so what do we do then? There's no guidance for this. How do we allow ourselves to recognize the shadow in us, the shadow in him? What most people do is we go into denial. That's the first defense against seeing the whole truth. And I interviewed so many people who said, oh, no, that can't be true. That's not happening. You know, this is somebody who has a problem who's making that up about the teacher. Or the teacher can't be alcoholic or he wouldn't be enlightened, right? Or she wouldn't be having sex, or she couldn't be enlightened, or she couldn't be so compassionate if she was telling a lie. And so we begin to use spiritual rationalization to deny and defend the situation we're in. And this goes on for decades with people. I mean, in the case of the Shambhala community in Boulder, Colorado, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, a Tibetan Buddhist teacher, you may have heard of him.
Yeah.
He was alcoholic. He was sexually abusive to women. And people were finding all kinds of ways to defend it and deny it. And when he died of alcoholism, no one believed it. He couldn't have been alcoholic because he was enlightened. Now, from my point of view, he was a brilliant teacher. His books were brilliant.
Yeah.
But he was very wounded. And he was an addict. And he was sexually abusive. And then he left his community to his heir, who continued to be sexually abusive, who got HIV/AIDS, continued to have sex with people, and gave AIDS to his students. And after he died, the third man who took over, who was the biological son of Trungpa, continued to act out sexually. And eventually had to be thrown out of the country. I think he went to Nepal. So three generations of abusive teachers, people are still in the community, still trying to rationalize and understand what happened.
Yeah.
And so I'm trying to use psychology to understand, how could this be? How could this kind of abuse be going on? And it's very widespread, tragically. Chapter 5 of the book tells the stories of dozens of people around the world who are really abusive teachers. And it's very disconcerting and frightening to know about this, and yet really necessary so that we can understand, what is enlightenment? How could people be in advanced stages of consciousness and still have shadows and still harm their students in such destructive ways?
I think this is commonly, we have this phenomenon of a halo effect, that if some person is very good in some field of life, we tend to see this halo in every part of this life, his or her life. And I think this Ken Wilber's integral theory has given a quite good understanding of what could be going on there. You are also mentioning his theory in your book about this different let's say, what were these called?
Lines of development.
Yeah, lines of development. For example, this quite commonly, I think, in spiritual or meditative circles, I've heard this grow up, wake up, clean up, this kind of three lines of development that you should work at least. And those, there could be more also, but at least these three are quite important and common sense developmental lines.
And so if a teacher is born into a lineage and told, you're the one from childhood, you know, you're the Dharma heir or you're the special chosen one, he's not going to do cleanup work. He's not going to do shadow work. He's not going to gain those tools. You know, Ken's other language for this is lines of development in terms of spiritual development, moral development, emotional development, cognitive development. They grow separately in us. So you can be very spiritually developed and morally corrupt. You haven't, if you haven't worked on your moral development and don't have conscience, that isn't necessarily going to change when you wake up spiritually. I went to, my husband and I went to India and we met a teacher in Rishikesh who was a Kundalini master who had lived on the streets as a sannyasin. So he was very advanced, but he had no emotional or relational development and never ever looked at me or spoke to me while we were there. He only spoke to my husband until I finally realized he was sexist. And so this is, you know, these lines of development are separate in us. The halo effect is incorrect in the sense that someone may be spiritually advanced and very almost retarded, you know, undeveloped in these other ways. And so waking up doesn't mean that everyone becomes a genius or an Einstein. It's not what happens.
Yeah, exactly. Something that I was thinking about was this tendency also in, let's say, in psychological circles to think about this kind of holy longing as some developmental issue in people, so that you could kind of try to explain it away. If you are an adult, you don't really need these kind of things, but of course this is quite a narrow viewpoint of human beings.
Well, I think the object of our longing can change over our lifetime. So for some people, the object of their longing is a romantic partner, and everything gets projected onto that, you know, and that does have developmental flavors to it, right? They don't want to be alone. They want an ideal person to mirror them. Whatever the needs are that are in that longing for the perfect partner, they are developmental needs. Some people long for home. You know, they spend a lot of time wandering and looking for the perfect home. And so the way that we imagine home, like in Islam, people long for paradise. And that's home. It isn't for a person. Often in Tibetan Buddhism, people long for the gods and they meditate on images of the gods, the god of compassion, you know. So they're not, it doesn't land on a person in the same way. And so I do think there are some developmental issues, but we don't want to risk reducing spirituality to psychology.
Yeah. Exactly.
Because that oversimplifies it. And that's always a risk of, you know, trying to understand things with psychology. There's always a risk of that. And we know that spirituality is more than psychology. Mm. We know that our spiritual nature is who we are, what we are. It's more than psychology.
Yeah.
And yet without psychology, we can really get into trouble.
Yeah, I think that the psychology tries to find ways to explain what is happening, but it doesn't really give the meaning of why, what is the kind of the reality itself, for example. It's more kind of explaining the phenomena in this reality, especially in the psychic realm. When you were talking about this Tibetan people, for example, longing for the gods, I was thinking about as Westerns, going to a movie theater and seeing the cards on the screen and being silent there for like 2.5 hours before the screen. So it's not so different. Meditation, of course, it's a little bit easier perhaps in that way. But I think that some common needs behind these things that Jung was also talking about.
I think one of the common needs is belonging. You know, there's so much loneliness. And in postmodern Western culture, the sort of goal of development is autonomy and being totally independent. And so in the shadow, because of that, in the shadow is the need to belong and to depend, to rely on someone, even to be told what to do by someone or how to think. That's the shadow side of the heroic ego that's autonomous and independent. So that need to belong gets people stuck in these communities where things are abusive or going awry. And people feel that if they leave, they'll be totally alone. I mean, when I left the TM movement in the 1970s, none of my friends would speak to me. I lost everyone. And many people have gone through that because many people have been told that will happen. You know, you'll be excommunicated and you'll be alone. And that is used as a threat to coerce people into obedience. So let's flip it around a little bit to the teachers. Whether it's a priest or minister, a rabbi, a roshi, a lama, a swami, a shaman, those human beings also have needs. And some of them have the need to be adored, even worshipped. And so they will coerce people to stay in that subordinate position in order to maintain the adoration. Some of them have the need to be obeyed, and they have a lot of power shadow. You know, why does that happen? And we can look at it psychologically, we can speculate. I think when you read chapter 5, you'll see that there's a lot of narcissism in these teachers who believe that they are immune to the consequences of their action. Now, you say that doesn't give us meaning, but for me, that psychological evaluation is really useful. It's helpful. It helps me to understand why some of this is happening. And you know, but they also have their human needs. And some of that is a need for sex. And so they may come from a monastery and a celibate tradition, and maybe in the East, and they come here and there's all this self-expression and sexual freedom. And they start having sex, maybe for the first time in their lives. And they continue to say that they're celibate. And this has happened over and over and over again, and it has shattered communities and shattered people's lives who can't tolerate this hypocrisy. And so there are many stories in the book about, you know, what has happened to communities as a result of this. And some of them have been able to recover and redesign themselves, and there are some stories about that. But some of them have not. And, you know, they have continued to put up with this behavior or to kick out the teacher and suffer with a lot of disorientation and loss.
Yeah.
So from the, you know, the teacher is also bringing unhealed wounds and shadow issues. And you know, the shadow is not a little corner in the head, right? Our mind body is all of a piece. And so there's shadow material in the body. And there's shadow material in the subtle body, in the chakras. So if there's shadow material in the sexual chakra, that could lead it, that could erupt and lead someone to act out sexually, you know. And same with the third chakra about power, it could lead someone to abuse power. And the teacher hasn't studied this, doesn't know psychology, doesn't know about the shadow. And so he or she is acting out impulsively. Yeah. And doesn't have that line, that psychological line of development to really know himself and know why he's, know his motivations for doing this.
Yeah. I think it was quite helpful for me also in the past to make this insight about how this is viewed from the kind of a teacher's or the authority's side, because it's quite easy to see how this is many times quite similar to some family dynamics. For example, a family of alcoholics or workaholics or some other dysfunction. Very similar patterns of behavior is happening in those families. And then when you think about the roles that people quite commonly take in these dysfunctional families, one of the roles is the hero role. And I think that many teachers could be quite, honest and trying to do good in their positions. And they feel the coercion of being that hero that people expect them to be. And it's not very easy to be in that kind of a projection position, because, of course, it's impossible task for a human being to kind of fulfill those kind of expectations. And then this shadow material that you were talking about, how it gets suppressed and, you don't want to meet it or face it, like I said in the beginning.
Yes, really good point. So there are teachers who are carrying the projections of millions of people. You know, some carry hundreds or thousands, but I mean, in India, they're carrying millions of people who don't see their humanity. They see the fantasy that they need to see of a perfect human being, a divine human. And that's very isolating. They don't have peer support, people they can talk to about their own suffering or their own blind spots, their own wounds. And so, as you're saying, in that position, it can be really uncomfortable, and they may act out because of that. They may try to get some intimacy from their students. Or they may compensate by trying to get rich. I mean, if you think about all of the gurus with the Rolls Royces and the jet planes and the elaborate estates that they're generating now, what is that about? I mean, people are working for them doing seva for nothing. The service that people give, or for a small stipend, and yet the teacher is getting rich. So what does that say about the teacher's lacks, emptiness, personal needs that aren't being acknowledged? So yeah, it's important to see it from both points of view, because both people are human and fallible and have valid needs that are not getting met in these situations.
Yeah. And also the point of view of the social dynamics, because we have this tendency to see people as autonomous individuals separated from each other, but the other viewpoint is this social side of people, like George Mead, for example, was theorizing this already 100 years ago, how people, how our mind and self is actually a social process. So we might have less kind of autonomy in that social process that we would like to think. So if these dynamics, these patterns of behavior are kind of happening in this groups, big groups or smaller groups, it can be quite difficult to, first of all, to see those patterns and kind of been able to change those, because it's not your individual choice. It's perhaps a dozen people that are contributing to those patterns, and your mind is also forming in these patterns. So not very easy task in that sense either.
Yes, there's a whole field of group dynamics and stages of development of groups. And, you know, from my point of view, I think what happens is these groups develop a spiritual persona, just like individuals develop a persona as children. You know, you got to be kind and polite and don't scream and don't hit, right? And certain feelings and behaviors get buried in the shadow. And the same thing happens in groups. You want to look happy and cheerful and polite so that other people join us. And they develop a spiritual persona, and a lot of material goes into the group shadow. Maybe anger, maybe grief, a whole range, maybe sexuality. A whole range of feeling can go into the group shadow. And then there's a group think that starts to happen, where people are taking on beliefs and not no longer engaging in critical thinking and really asking themselves, do I genuinely believe that, or am I just taking it in from the group? And so these kinds of issues are part of the recovery process of beginning to identify what you gave away in order to belong to the group and in order to be acknowledged by the teacher and receive approval. So what is in the persona and what is buried in the shadow? Often the body is shamed in a lot of traditions. And, you know, spirit and flesh are split, right? And celibate traditions, sexual impulses are bad. And so they get stuffed into the shadow. And so what happens as you begin to reclaim your bodily instincts? I had a woman say to me in an interview, I knew my body knew it was dangerous, and I just kept ignoring it. And so we deny our bodily cues, our gut instincts, in order to remain in the group and be close to the teacher. So there's a lot going on here, and there's a lot, you know, I call the recovery work spiritual shadow work. So there's a lot of material to begin to reclaim and recover in order to heal from spiritual betrayal.
Yeah. So when we are talking about the shadow work, what are we talking about? What does it involve?
So the basic method that I developed to work with the shadow is in Romancing the Shadow, that book. And then in order to work with the shadows around age, the inner work of age uses that method. So, for example, the inner ageist is an unconscious part of us that has internalized the ageism of the culture and the institutions, and feels ashamed or unhappy about our bodies as they change or our minds as they change, because we're ageist against ourselves. That's just an example. So in spirituality, as I was just describing, we have buried a lot in the shadow in order to maintain a devotional relationship or a membership in a community or a group, a church, a synagogue, a sangha, whatever it is. And so we begin to learn how to identify what is in the shadow and how to reclaim it, how to bring it out into the light. And so we start with the projection. What are we projecting onto this person that really belongs inside of us? And we can explore that, and we can look at, am I giving away compassion to this person that I really want to cultivate in myself? or am I giving away my own spiritual light, the light, my nature as a spirit? Am I giving that away? How do I cultivate that for myself? What practices do I need in order to reclaim that projection onto the teacher? And the same with all the authentic feelings that I talked about. If we're burying feelings, we want to begin to cultivate them and bring them into awareness. Same with thoughts. If we've buried our doubts because the teacher said, you know, ignore the mind. Thoughts are just fleeting and they don't have any information for you. You want to transcend your thoughts. Then we're not examining all of the intelligent information that our minds are giving us. And we want to begin to explore that and take it back. In meditation, you may have the intention to go beyond the mind. But in the waking state, that's not appropriate if you want to do spiritual shadow work. Same with the body. So, you know, what happens when you start bringing back body awareness? It's very scary for some people. You know, it feels risky because they've been cut off from their bodily knowledge for so long. And agency, how do you begin to act in your own behalf? If you've been subordinate and obedient, how do you begin to act and speak up and face the risk of that? How do you become a whistleblower in a situation where others may need you to act in their behalf? How do you find the resilience to do that, to face the fear, to face the shadows, and to begin to do that? And so this is, for me, what spiritual shadow work is about. Now, some people experience direct, overt abuse. And in those situations, they may have PTSD. They may be suffering from anxiety, sleep issues, nightmares, depression. And in those cases, some of those people need to do therapy. They need to be able to work on PTSD in a way that they can relieve some of the trauma. And this is an individual process. I'm not prescribing same thing for everybody. Other people will want to stay in their communities and not leave. And they will want to maybe speak up and try to rebuild, redesign things. So I have examples of that, for such as Kripalu Yoga Center, when it was found that the teacher was having sex with students. The whole thing came crashing down. And over a period of years, they brought in consultants and therapists, and they redesigned the systems. Yeah. So that the systems of the institution were no longer colluding with the abuse of power and the abuse of women.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I tell that story about the LA Zen Center as well. So, you know, this is an individual journey. It takes, for some people, it may take a long time. For others, they're ready to leave and it can, you know, happen more easily. And I wanted to invite our listeners to online groups that are for people who want to read the book and do this work in community. So if you're interested in spiritual shadow work and recovery from religious abuse or spiritual disillusionment, you can shoot me an email, Connie Zweig, Z-W-E-I-G, @gmail.com. Please put spiritual shadow work in the subject line and send me your time zone. And I will connect you to a group in your area so that you can go through the book and explore this process together in community. These groups are all over the world now, and they're really supporting each other and forming safe and intimate bonds to be able to explore this. There's so many people from so many denominations who have suffered this kind of trauma and really, you know, don't know where to go for support. So these free online groups are available to you.
Yeah, that's excellent. One thing that I was thinking when you were describing this shadow work is that I think that many people have this concept of shadow. They think it's something bad or immoral or negative, but it's quite clear when I listen to you that the shadow isn't that. It doesn't mean that, but it's more like something that is hidden, something that you're not meeting. So
that's right. Yeah. So anything at all can be in the shadow. It's only negative in relation to the ego. The ego finds it unacceptable. But if you're a child and you're in a family that only values academic achievement, and you're an artist, you're a natural artist, you want to paint and draw, or you're a natural athlete that wants to do sports, and that's not permitted by your family, they say that's a waste of time and they dismiss it, then those aptitudes and gifts are going to go into the shadow. So the artist in you may be buried for many years until maybe at midlife, you know, it comes roaring out and you start taking art classes and you leave your job to become an artist. My literary agent has left the business world in order to paint full time. She didn't know she was an artist. But she started to remember that that's what was happening in her childhood, and her parents were telling her that wasn't valuable. So anything at all can become shadow content. It's negative in relation to the ego because the ego tells us it's bad. It's not welcome. It's not acceptable. It's even taboo. But you're right. There's a popular misconception of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And same with the holy longing, you know, the holy longing can be in the shadow because, right, at our spiritual yearning for more, which is a deep message from the soul, can be buried in the shadow. If we're taught that we should only focus on making money, that's all that matters, that's what's important. And we build a career and we build a family. And then all of a sudden, at midlife or in a late life identity crisis, we realize, oh my God, I spent so many years focused on this one thing. And what's really in my heart is this yearning for something more.
Yeah, this is something that I wanted to turn us back towards this holy longing, because behind this need for the shadow work and all that we were discussing is I think there's something that we are going towards. You know, that's why it might be important not just to dismiss the whole, you know, meditation or spirituality or whatever and go towards something else, because there might be something very important for us behind all that. And so this phrase holy longing, like I said, I like this very much. Can you tell me something about this, that what you have found, what is the kind of holy longing for?
Well, you know, I think it's interesting that in our world today, there are so many urgent crises, interconnected, pressing crises that we're all facing. And at the same time, there are so many people experiencing spiritual awakening. If you look at the podcast, Buddha at the Gas Pump, Bat Gap, you can hear, I think, 700 people who are having experiences of spiritual awakening. So how is it possible that those two things are happening at the same time? It's really interesting to me. And I think that if you can do your trauma work and recover from difficult experiences, you'll begin to hear that call or feel that sensation of restlessness or that feeling of longing again. It's the soul's inherent whisper to us, to the ego. It's the soul's whisper telling us there's more. There are possibilities. I live with a man who's in a very high advanced level of consciousness. And so every day I recognize that's the purpose of a human life. That's the purpose of meditation practice. We're not only here to live a conventional life of, you know, career and family. That can be deeply gratifying. It can bring us meaning. And there's more. And this voice that's telling us there's more is valid. It's a valid message to us.
Yeah. I think that your book was a little bit different also in that sense that you bring up this topic of awakening, spiritual awakening in the last part of the book, because it's all too easy to kind of just say that, well, it's all illusion, you know, this spiritual work and meditation. It's just something that we, a compensation for something or something like that. And the healing process is to kind of get rid of those illusions. But your kind of approach is more like, no, there might be something very real and important behind that. So
yeah, it's not that there might be. There is.
Yes.
There is. And, you know, and I've experienced, and many of these teachers who were acting out their shadows are in higher levels of consciousness. I believe that. So it's easy to dismiss it and say, well, if he's having sex, he's not enlightened. Or if she's lying to us, she's not awake, right? But, or if it's, you know, a Christian clergy person, well, if he's lying, then he's not really connected to God. Whatever your language or your framework is, it's easy to dismiss. But what I'm saying is there are people who are in higher stages of consciousness, and Ken Wilber's, I think, map of this is really helpful and really excellent. And you can be in a higher stage of consciousness and still be undeveloped morally, still be unaware of your shadow and unaware of your own psychological needs and why you're acting them out. And that's really the message here. It's complex. It's nuanced. I mean, the bottom line is awakening is not what we thought it was, right? It doesn't mean we're perfect. That's just not, there is no perfect human being. And so cultivating shadow awareness can enable us to remain or return to spiritual life without the naivete of our youth, but with spiritual maturity. With an awareness of the complexity of human beings.
Yeah, exactly. I think my own path to meditation and these kind of things went through spiritual experiences that were not related to any religion or practices that I was doing. But I had these glimpses to these things, and that led me to study meditation and to becoming a psychologist and study the mind and all that. But in my experiences in these disillusions, in these traditions, there was this time that I kind of would have wanted to just say that, well, it's all, you know, something that I could just dismiss and, you know, focus on building a career or money or whatever. But on the other hand, I cannot deny those experiences and the meaningfulness that they bring to life is very real.
I think you're describing what a lot of people have felt. You know, and that loss of faith or loss of motivation or disillusionment is a moment on the path. And I like to say that meeting the shadow on the spiritual path doesn't mean you're off the path.
Exactly.
It's a part of the human journey and maybe a necessary, inevitable part of it in order to really become initiated into the shadow. It's an initiation. And to move through that dark passage into spiritual maturity, into the ability to hold the darkness and the light, and not just split off one over the other. It's all light or it's all dark. But to be able to hold the whole enchilada of what a human being and what the spiritual journey is really about.
Yeah, that's very important point. And that's very important viewpoint, because this is something that people miss very easily.
Right.
Like you said, it's not that now you're off the path. This can be a phase in the path that will be very important. And if you can work with it, it will give you so much as a human being.
And so if you're resonating with this and you would like to read the book with other people, please shoot me an email, conniezweig@gmail.com. Put spiritual shadow work in the subject line and give me your time zone. Please don't write a long story, because I get hundreds of emails every day, but give me your time zone and I will be happy to connect you to do spiritual shadow work in community.
Yeah.
Thank you so, so much. I really enjoyed this.
Yeah, me too. Thank you. Thank you very much, Connie.
Tämä oli Mielen laboratorio. Jos kärsit meditaation tai mindfulness-harjoitusten haittavaikutuksista, tsekkaa rakentamani online-kurssi osoitteesta mielenlaboratorio.thinkific.com. Kurssilla on kattava tieto meditaation haittavaikutuksista sekä ohjeita yksilöllisten harjoituspolkujen rakentamiseen. Tutustu myös kirjoihini Mielen laboratorio ja Mindfulness, mielenselkeys ja myötätunto. Jälkimmäinen löytyy nyt myös äänikirjana kaikista suosituimmista äänikirjapalveluista. Jos pidit jaksosta, suosittele sitä myös ystävillesi, jotta hekin pääsevät tutustumaan oman mielensä sokkeloihin.